This is an ABC podcast.
Can criticism of religion cross a line and become racism? Can you separate the believer from the belief? And in the aftermath of the Christchurch mosque massacres, is the question simply too hard? Well, not this week on the Religion and Ethics Report. I'm Andrew West. Welcome to the program. A conference later this month will look at race and religion and will give you a preview of the debate. First, though, it's probably the most controversial book written about the Catholic Church in the past decade, and the title says it all, In the Closet of the Vatican. Now, in this new book, the French author and sociologist Frédéric Martel alleges 80% of Vatican staff are secretly gay. And Martel, who's openly gay himself, says this culture has had disastrous consequences. He argues that the secrecy around legal adult gay relationships has led to a much wider cover-up of the clerical sexual abuse crisis. Frédéric Martel is coming to Australia in June for Hobart's Dark Mofo Arts Festival, and he's speaking here with ABC religion specialist Noel de Bien.
When you work in the Vatican with 27 priests that are gay, like I have done, then you interview 40 cardinals and 50 bishops and many priests and so on. And then you understand how they work and you see the information you get from all these people, you have the impression that the numbers are very high. We can also put it in another way, and I'm sorry to go in this direction because, of course, there is no link between homosexuality and sexual abuse. But if you look at abuse of priests around the world, you have 5,948 priests in the US that are either in jail or accused or with a kind of soupçon of abusing men.
1,880 yes, exactly. Here in Australia.
1,670 in Germany, 800 in Netherlands, 500 in Belgium, and so on and so forth. All these people were all supposed to be not interested in sex. So they are only the cases under investigation. So I believe celibacy and chastity is a lie. What I'm doing is to denounce the system and a system of lie.
Your book, actually, to quote it, you said that its intention is to understand why Benedict XVI, and you say so obsessive in his war against legal homosexual acts, seemed powerless in the face of sexual abuse of minors. You do somehow put the two things side by side, don't you? So why do you argue that the worldwide criminal mismanagement of this by the Vatican and its representatives might be somehow related to closeted gay clergy? What's the link?
Homosexuality and abuse have no link. All the studies and statistics we have try to prove that the abuse are mainly heterosexual from straight families and from straight people in schools, and the victims are very, very large number, women or girls.
Yes.
When you go to the church, then there is a singularity that shows that the cases and the victims are mainly underage boys or men, which means in the church, sexual abuse are homosexual abuse. And it's the case by 80 to 85% if you use the study of the bishops in the US or Spotlight.
It's the same here in Australia too.
85%. So there is a specificity. I am gay and actively gay supporter, but we need also to be serious. That's a reality. So then you need to understand why in the church the victims of the abuse are mainly men and boys. So first of all, it's a world of men. Second of all, a lot of the priests that have been accused, they deny the fact that they were interested in men. So their homosexuality, proved by the tribunal because they acted with men and boys, is quite often a repressed homosexuality. It's self-hate. So the problem is not homosexuality. It is repressed homosexuality. And then the key element linking homosexuality and abuse is the cover-up. A lot of the priests, a lot of the bishops and cardinals that protected abusers, the majority of them are homosexual. And they protect the abusers Not because they are okay with abuse, but because they are afraid for themselves. And they are afraid of a scandal. And because of that, then their reaction is to avoid any public scandal and to move the priest to another parish. Another element is the culture of secrecy. And to finish, I would say, you know, I'm a sociologist. Whenever you look, for example, on Durkheim on suicide, we know that it's an individual case. The abuser is an individual. He made something wrong. It's a crime, and he should be punished for that. But we also know, as sociologists, that when you have so many cases, thousands of cases in Australia and the US and so on, it's also a sociological and a collective system. So we need to look not just of the individuals that are guilty, but also to the system that encourages, protects, and sometimes gets silent on the system.
So if I'm understanding correctly, your book argues that because the Catholic Church has a culture of repressed homosexuality, including a majority of its clergy, it hides this, and therefore that links to a behaviour which hides sexual behaviour, and that then included the abuse of minors. Is that what you're saying?
Yes and no. Yes, the two things are linked. No, because nobody wants to protect abusers. And the confusion of that has been the case forever in the church. Benedict XVI has never made a difference between homosexuality in a legal relation and any kind of abuse that are not legal. And if you make this confusion, you shouldn't be surprised that the priests and the bishops and the cardinal are themselves lost about their own sexuality.
Is what you are saying that a misunderstanding or a denial of how human sexuality actually works is at the bottom of this problem? Is that what you're saying?
I think yes.
In your book, you talk about same-sex marriage in relation to this, that the Vatican's relationship to that issue or its reaction to that issue needs to be understood as well. You say it started with the Netherlands in 2001, 19 years ago, on April 1st, actually. Why was that Dutch decision important in trying to understand how the Vatican would deal with this issue of sexuality and also, by link, its ability to deal with the discipline of clergy in general?
Until 1969, to take the birthday of Stonewall, the gay liberation, exactly 50 years ago, homosexuality was a crime in the majority of the countries in the world.
Yes.
So the church was basically against homosexuality, but the society also was. Actually, the church was a safe house for homosexuals. They were protected in a society that was, to a large extent, homophobic. Then things began to change in the 80s and even more in the 90s. First of all, with decriminalization of homosexuality in every democratic country in the world, and then with civil unions, and then with same-sex marriage. And it became a totally different world with large number of homosexuals, but at the same time with homosexuality being okay outside of the church. And then you get a big gap between church life and society. And to keep this world of homosexuality and homophilia within the church, they needed to be much more homophobic. And you have the explanation why, for the church, decriminalization of homosexuality, civil union, and of course homosexual marriage became a scandal. They needed to fight against that evolution because their own secrecy was a problem during the sexual liberation.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report, and I'm Andrew West, and you're listening to a discussion between my colleague Noel Debien and the French author Frédéric Martel about his explosive new book, In the Closet of the Vatican. It claims the Vatican is run by gay cardinals and bishops who are hiding their sexuality. And Noel asked Martel about the powers of the Vatican Department, known as the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And the answer, as you'll hear, was especially revealing.
Here in Australia, we had a plebiscite on same-sex marriage. And I'm aware now of at least one prominent Catholic leader who has been investigated by the CDF, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, for saying that a Catholic could in conscience vote yes for civil same-sex marriage. How should we understand the CDF's interest in the politics of same-sex marriage in countries like Australia? Should other bishops who said it was okay to vote yes in conscience, should they be worried about the CDF?
Of course, they are worried. You have a structure that is a structure of power. You have a structure that doesn't allow dissent. The organization is run by very old 80-plus, 90-plus cardinals. So the core of all the problem, where there is abuse, of course, but also the place of women, the place of homosexuality, the discussion about many other scandals, about money and so on, are linked to clericalism, the fact that the organization always protects itself. So whenever you speak as a priest or even as a bishop somewhere in the world in favor of condoms or in favor of same-sex marriage or in favor of women becoming priests, you have very big sanction by the Vatican.
You spoke to Krzysztof Karamsa. Now, he was in the CDF, wasn't he? Why was he important to your story? Just tell us who he is.
Karamsa is a Polish priest that worked for decades inside the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. And by the way, I know very well this building. And actually, it is a gay building. A lot of the people living there and working there are gay. And we have proof now that inside this building, the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, in the apartment on the second and third floor, they organize what we call chemsex parties, parties with sex and drugs. And it is common knowledge now. The person living in one of the apartments was arrested by the Vatican police and put in jail because of drug consumption. So that's also the story of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. It is very hypocritical itself because you have both the place where you decide to be very homophobic and the place where a lot of gay people were. And Karamsa, the priest, Krzysztof Karamsa, was like that.
In fact, you quote Karamsa saying, and he's talking about the CDF here, since many of them are homosexual, these clergy impose a hatred of homosexuals, which is to say self-hatred, in a desperate masochistic act. Now, how seriously do you take Karamsa saying that?
If somebody is saying something publicly on record, I think you need to trust him. At the same time, there is also people that deny what he says. Other people deny what I'm saying in the book, and I quote them. I think it's normal journalism to have all the points of view of a very difficult question.
If you were to compare John Paul II, Benedict XVI, and Francis, which you do effectively in your book, how do you compare the response of each of these three popes to the same-sex marriage question, but also the problem of clerical sexual abuse, the two things?
John Paul II was totally silent. Maybe Cardinal Sodano and the assistants Dzivic, which are the key villains of my book, maybe they didn't communicate with him the information they got on sexual abuse. So it is possible that John Paul II didn't know. If you take Benedict XVI, he was a fighter against gay people and against gay marriage. At the same time, he was very silent on sexual abuse until the end. He acted a bit on Ireland. He was also acting against Marcial Maciel in Mexico. But overall, he was not a key figure of the fight against sexual abuse. And then you have Francis. Francis, in fact, knows everything very well. He was very well informed about homosexuality, was very well informed of the problem of the church, and he tried to reform it. And, you know, he's maybe too old to really be able to change the church.
Your book, which is large, over 500 pages in English, quite complex in the arguments it makes, and it covers a lot of ground, could be used by conservatives in the Catholic Church to say that the real problem here is homosexuality and what we need to do is get rid of homosexual clergy. I gather you're aware of that.
I was aware of that. And it's true also that in the beginning, early February, when my book was already discussed around the world, but nobody read it, a lot of extremely right media and so on were saying, oh, we are so happy. For the first time, a gay liberal will tell actually the story that we are saying for years. But then they read the book. And when you read the book, chapter number 2 is about Cardinal Burke. And Cardinal Burke is supposed to be the most important figure of the extreme right Catholicism in the US. And when you read my chapter, they discovered that this book is not for them. And they basically became enemy of the book because they understand that whenever you are very rigid, whenever you are very homophobic, whenever you are very obsessed by homosexuality and sexuality, you might be gay yourself. So when they discover the argument, the core argument of the book, which is as much as somebody is homophobic, as much as he's probably gay, they were not able to use the book in their favor.
Well, I must ask you this question then, because I did read the section on Cardinal Burke with interest. He's, of course, the American cardinal noted for his very hardline conservative views on homosexuality, on the church, and against progressive thought. And he likes to dress in lace and beautiful vestments. But your book actually reaches no conclusion about him. Why did you not draw a conclusion? You leave it to the reader, don't you?
For many reasons. I mean, some people have said, and I'm not speaking specifically to Cardinal Burke, because Cardinal Burke is a drag queen. So it's not even about homosexuality, it's about drag queen. He is a drag queen. So the debate is on another subject. My goal is not to discuss the homosexuality of Cardinal A or Cardinal B. My goal is not to out them. I don't out any living cardinal. What I'm doing is to try to understand the system. I don't out individual persons, I out the Vatican.
That's the controversial author of the new book, In the Closet of the Vatican, the French sociologist Frédéric Martel, speaking with Noel Debien. And you're with Andrew West. As we reflect on the Christchurch mosque massacres, when an Australian white nationalist murdered 51 Muslims who were simply praying, the debate about religion, race and culture continues to bubble away. The opponents of Islam say, look, it's a religion, it's not a race, so a critique of the belief isn't racist. But is that simply too easy? Well, a conference later this month at Western Sydney University will bring together some of Australia's top religion scholars, including Professor Fethi Mansouri. He holds the UNESCO chair at Deakin University and is a global expert on Islam and integration. The co-convener of the conference is Dr. Rosie Hancock of Notre Dame University. She joined me and Fethi Mansouri for this discussion about race and religion.
For something to become racialized means that a particular specific characteristics are ascribed as being inherent and natural to each and every member of that particular group. So in the case of Islam, often the racialization of Islam means that characteristics such as violence or incivility, anti-Semitism or fundamentalism are ascribed to Muslims.
Fethi, do we simply confuse race and religion these days? When we're asked to imagine, for example, a Muslim, do we have a particular racial type in mind?
Not only do we have a particular racial or ethnic type in mind when we invoke the word Muslim, but we also attach to that certain characteristics which are inherently problematic for what we can call now a liberal Western democracy. And some of those inherent characteristics will imply things like irrationality, a rejection of certain democratic norms, a willingness not to accept certain liberal values in relation to freedom, etc. We are loading it with what I would call a number of ethical and moral infectors. We're infecting the characterization of a Muslim in a way that we therefore justify aggressive actions that we can take against those particular individuals and communities. Okay. And I think what's happened in Christchurch is a deplorable manifestation of this kind of thinking.
I know this conference deals with more than just the Islamic faith, but let's deal with this question that's so often brought up. And I'll start with you, Fethi. I accept that it is too easy to say, oh, well, look, Islam is a religion. It's not a race. If I criticize Islam, I'm not being racist. I know that's an easy way out. But isn't it also true that one of Islam's great strengths is that it's not ethno-specific? Not all Muslims speak the same language. Most Muslims aren't Arabs.
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew. As a matter of fact, if you look at the 1.6 or maybe now close to 1.7 billion Muslims globally, you'll find that those who are perhaps provide the caricature, the image that many people would have, which is the Arab, perhaps even the Arabian Muslim, would be really a very small proportion of that, not even, I think, 20% of the whole Muslim population. There's a deeply rooted sense of diversity within the global Muslim Ummah, both ethnically, culturally, linguistically, and geographically too. What has been very problematic in depicting Islam and Muslims is a very banal, simplistic depiction that reduces that richness into a very, very problematic prototype. And I think that's what really has hurt the image of Islam and the Muslim communities, whether it's in Muslim-majority societies, which are always looked at as if they are inferior, incapable of embracing the modernist project, so to speak, or Muslims who are even born in Western secular societies, who will always be looked upon as if they are incapable of integrating socially and politically and at the community level, simply because they carry with them a heritage culture and a heritage faith, which, again, almost systematically not allow them to embrace social integration as we understand it now.
Rosie, you've worked extensively with Muslim communities, including in Jordan. Does the point there that we've made about Islam being, if you like, a multinational faith, not an ethno-specific faith, does that then lend some credence to the idea that one can critique Islam as a faith without engaging in racial prejudice?
I want to make a distinction here between a critique of a religion and discrimination, and also between like an intellectual critique of a religion and systematic discrimination or systemic racism. So what I'm talking about, for example, thinking of each and every member of the group that is Muslims, all 1.6 billion of them, as necessarily having the characteristics of being violent or being anti-democratic and incivil. That is discriminatory. That gets woven into particular types of policy and state legislation that has a real impact on the lives of each and every Muslim, even though actually each and every Muslim is not like that at all. The problem here is saying a critique that applies to absolutely everyone, as though it is inherent and natural, rather than having a legitimate intellectual critique of a religion or of an individual within that religion, let's say.
It cuts both ways, though, doesn't it? Because if you've got the rank Islamophobe who attacks particularly a Muslim woman, if not necessarily physically, but attacks them rhetorically for wearing the veil, at the same time, some Muslim women who don't wear the veil see themselves as being treated as inauthentic. Even Dr. Anne Ali, a distinguished member of the Federal Parliament, a Muslim woman, has said, oh yes, I've been attacked by hardliners as not being authentically Muslim enough. So this question of identity cuts both ways, doesn't it?
What this demonstrates is that communities are incredibly diverse and there is difference within communities. And so when we racialize a religion like Muslims, we are, and Fethi has said this, we're being very reductive. We're saying everyone is like this. All 1.6 billion are like this. But actually, these instances that you bring up that show that internal diversity within Islam show us that actually we can't make assumptions. We can't say that any particular characteristic is natural to all Muslims.
Fethi, is there a tendency for some people to fetishize Islam? People who think they're being positive about Islam, they fetishize.
I think there are different dynamics at play here, and I like perhaps the assumption behind the question, which is how do we deal with some of these internal dynamics within a very diverse Muslim community, whether it's people fetishizing Islam or whether people perhaps even feel as if they've been ostracized as a Muslim, like you gave an example there. My take on all of this and the kind of work we trying to pursue here is trying to reconcile a possibility of having both a group-based notion of belonging and identity within a liberal society, which, of course, emphasizes individual citizenship. How can we actually achieve this? So far, we've obviously talked about national citizenship and nationalism being a driving force. But what we've seen recently is that nationalism is manifesting in some very ugly ideologies, in particular either the far right or the jihadist terrorist individuals who join up with like-minded groups. And what we are wanting to really communicate is that multiculturalism does provide us both the possibility of group belonging, so to speak, a possibility of being part of a national community, that's your citizenship, you assert your right to be a citizen and to be accepted as Australian, but at the same time also having individualistic tendencies where you can be different from your members of the particular ethno-religious group. So you navigate the individual, the group, and the national without saying I'm a citizen of the world, so to speak. So you have rooted belonging in Australia, but you also have the possibility of identifying with a particular cultural group without threatening the national fabric, without threatening the national identity. So we pursue the argument that multicultural citizenship is the only way forward in navigating some of these tensions within and between groups, because ultimately the test is, are we able to extend the same rights to everyone? And many people would say that it has not been the case always.
Rosie, where is public policy failing? Because part of what your conference is trying to do is, I suspect, address some of those gaps in public policy. Where do you think public policy is failing on this question of integration or people confusing race and religion? And then we have these horrific, violent manifestations of that.
It's very common in public policy and in legislation to think that religion can explain political behaviour. I think that that is an incorrect assumption to make, that you can't make policy or make legislation that takes a religious group as a subject and says, we think that this group is going to act in this particular way because they are a member of that group. A lot of the security policy, for example, takes being a Muslim as a sufficient reason for surveillance. Being a Muslim is not a good predictor for particular types of behaviour that might require surveillance. That is one example of that. But I think in a way, valorising religious identity as a something that can make sense of a person or as the primary form of identity for someone actually obscures the complex nature of being an individual, as Fetty was talking about, that an individual in a multicultural society negotiates themselves and the groups to which they belong and the nation. And that's a very complex negotiation. And I think that policy doesn't do enough yet in that space.
That's Dr. Rosie Hancock, co-convener of a conference later this month at Western Sydney University on religion and race, and the UNESCO professor at Deakin University, Fethi Mansouri, who's one of the key speakers. And there's a link to that conference at our website. That's the Religion and Ethics Report for this week. You can find us at the RN website or the ABC Listen app. Thanks to Nadiet El-Ghouli and Bryce Halliday. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.